Welcome into the Podium Game Podcast. We're going to try something a little different this time. I went out to a King shoot around before they played the Suns last week. I talked to Nick Stauskas for about 5-6 minutes. We're going to play that, and then we're going to go check in with Rob Mahoney from Sports Illustrated, go around the rest of the NBA. All right, so coming up right here is Kings rookie shooting guard Nick Stauskas.
All right, so I'm just going to be honest, I'm a Michigan fan.
Okay.
So, and I realized I was prepping for it. I've probably been a Michigan fan since before you were alive, so I felt really old.
Nice.
So, let me ask a trivia question for you.
Okay.
You wore number 11. There's a guy who shot a bunch of threes, played before, wore number 11, was my favorite player growing up. Do you know who that is?
At Michigan?
Yes.
Number 11. Lewis Bullock.
Yes. All right.
Yeah.
Awesome. Happy you got that.
Yeah.
All right, so you guys... last 2 years did really well in the NCAA tournament.
Yeah.
When you made it to the Final Four, what's it like going from the highs of that Saturday to what happens on Monday? What's the emotion like from such a quick turnaround?
You mean like winning against Syracuse?
Yeah, and yeah.
It was tough. Like, definitely just getting... I feel like we all had our hopes up. You know, we made it that far. You just expect to win. And obviously only one team can win, so... For me, it motivated me. I didn't have a good game, not even play that many minutes. So that really just motivated me, that loss, and me not playing well, just wanted me to get better throughout the summer. So it kind of just left a bad taste in my mouth until the season started again the next year.
Did Spike ever talk or meet with Kate Upton? Did anything ever?
No, unfortunately not. I wish it did, though.
That was one of the funny. I remember I was at the game. I was sitting up there, and he's doing that. I was like, holy crap, they're really going to win this game.
Yeah, not many people. When Spike started doing that, you had that feeling. It was almost like a Cinderella story kind of thing. I thought we were going to win it, but, Louisville was a great team. They made a lot of great plays down the stretch of the game, and, they deserve to win that game.
Luke Hancock favorited a tweet of mine on Twitter. I was just joking around, and I was like, he got elbowed or hit hard during summer league, and I was like, oh, that guy deserves that. And he searched his name, and he favored it. I was like, oh, I feel kind of bad. I don't actually wish anything bad.
Yeah.
I was just joking around.
Sometimes as a fan, you want to, say things like that, but you don't really mean it. Yeah.
So your 2 years there, you played two pretty different roles. The first year, you played off Trey Burke a lot, did a lot of spot-up stuff with secondary ball handler.
Yeah.
Second year, the offense kind of ran free a lot.
Yeah.
How did that help prepare you for the NBA?
I think I'm, and even for me, it's now an adjustment going back to that role of being, being a role player and the ball not always going through me. I had a year of that at Michigan where my role was pretty much the same as on this team where, they want me to make plays when I can, but for the most part, I'm here to space the floor and knock down shots for this team. So, I've experienced that, and I've also experienced, everything going through me and being the go-to guy. So, I know, I got to be patient, with my role here, and I just got to continue to work and learn from these veteran guys, and eventually my time will come.
Feeling pressure, it seemed like you watched those Grantland videos. The owner really wanted you on this team. Did you feel any extra pressure because of that?
Not necessarily. I feel like at the end of the day, it's just basketball, and I just got to work my hardest and play my game. And, if I do that, everything else will take care of itself. I don't try to put, any added pressure on myself.
And now, at Michigan, you guys were a very guard-oriented offense.
Yeah.
Here you got a guy in the wing, and Jay, and Cousins, who they run a lot of stuff through. How is that changing the game at all?
Basically just... even at Michigan when I was, when I was playing more of a spot-up role, it was more spotting up, waiting to play off Trey Burke and Tim Hardaway, other guards. And now, a lot of time the ball's in the post, and I got to learn how to move without the ball when someone has the ball in the post and kind of read, what he's seeing. So it's a different feel. It's a different read for me, but I'm getting adjusted to it.
Is it harder in a way because a point guard's so used to making those passes that they hit you in your right spots better than a big man does?
Not necessarily. It's just really getting used to, DeMarcus's, his tendencies and when he likes to pass, when he likes to score. We're only 5 games into the season, so we're just figuring each other out right now.
What's it been like watching him? I mean, I've caught a couple of your guys. It's been amazing.
Personally, I think he's the best big in the NBA. There's not many people that can dominate in the post the way he does, so I got a lot of respect for him, and I think that, this is just the beginning of a very bright career for him.
Have you had your welcome to the NBA moment yet?
Yeah, I did. couple nights ago when we were in Denver, I checked into the game, and in 90 seconds I picked up three fouls. And now they just, every play they posted me up, and every time they called a foul, so, and I didn't come in for the rest of the game. So that was my welcome to the NBA moment.
The Big Ten, they let you play more than in the NBA, don't they?
Yeah. You know, the Big Ten, they did, it was a physical league, they definitely let you play, but, you know, there's a different, I feel like the rules do change a little bit in the NBA, so I'm just getting adjusted to, you know, what I can and can't do as far as, you know, guarding people in the post and on the perimeter and hand-checking, all those different types of rules.
Thoughts on Michigan this year? How do you think they're going to be?
I think they're going to be great. You know, as long as they have those coaches there, I think they're going to be just fine, because those coaches do a great job of putting the players in, you know, the best positions to succeed. You know, they got a strong returning group. You know, freshmen from last year, Derek and Zach Irvin, and you know, of course, Caris LeVert expected to have a breakout year. So, you know, I think they got a lot of good things coming out of them.
And then, lastly, have you talked to Nash since he hasn't been able to play? I know you have the connection with him.
No, haven't talked to him directly, but I sent him a text quickly and just said, hey, you know, I hope all is well, and you know, just trying to keep his spirits up. You know, I know it must have been tough for him, so you know, I know he probably saw it.
Now we're joined by Rob Mahoney, who got to see Nick Stauskas Tuesday night when the Kings were in Dallas facing the Mavericks. We've already talked a little about the Kings, so let's hit the other side with the Mavs first. Rob, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm anxious to be at the part of the season where we can actually decide to, you know, figure out what's real, what's not real. We're kind of nearing that point now.
I like the beginning of the season because it's here. But it's also hard to, like, generate content, and you're doing stuff that you know you're like, all right, I have to write this because this is my job to write stuff about the NBA, but there's not enough info to be really doing it the right way yet.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of anxiousness, there's a lot of excitement, a lot of, you know, certain guys who you want to see do well for whatever reason, and certainly the waiting game in terms of figuring out what is the appropriate sample size is an excruciating one.
What have been your early impressions of the Mavericks as they're coming off a pretty impressive comeback win against the Kings?
I mean, the offense, I think, is probably about where you would expect. It's a little more up and down, maybe, than anticipated. You know, there have been a lot of problematic third quarters, and then on Tuesday night, it was kind of the other way around, where the first half was a disaster. But overall, still the best offense in the NBA, which is, you know, figured they were going to be somewhere in the top three or so. So, you know, all is going according to plan on that end. The defense probably, you know, should have seen a little bit more of the problems coming. Tyson Chandler's certainly doing what he can, and he's looked pretty good for the most part. But when you only have one, you know, above-average defender in your starting lineup, there are going to be some problems there. And so Rick Carlisle has his hands full in terms of balancing out, you know, when is the right time to put Alfred Camino in for Chandler Parsons. You know, to what extent he can get away with these really undersized, you know, backcourts with Jameer Nelson and Monte Ellis and Devin Harris. I mean, it's a balancing act, and it's going to be all season. It's just going to be a question of whether the Mavs can get to, you know, hovering around the league average defensively, which is kind of where they need to target right now.
Do you think they need to upgrade a point guard to become a true contender? Do you think they can get away with what they have there?
I mean, it couldn't hurt. It's one of those things where it's like when we talk about upgrades at point guard, so often we're talking about guys who are great playmakers or great shooters. And I don't know that the Mavs need that. They just need somebody who can guard that position a little bit more reliably than they have now. Devin Harris is their best option right now, and he does a fine job. But then, you know, he takes away a little bit on the other end, you know, forces some shots here and there, isn't necessarily the cleanest guy in terms of initiating the offense. So they have this mixed bag in terms of what they're working with at point guard. It would certainly help, especially when you're talking about, you know, San Antonio is going to get right eventually. There's some hiccups with them there. And then when Oklahoma City gets healthy again, you know, these upper echelon Western Conference teams, in addition to, you know, the Houstons and the Golden States and these teams that have already played very well to start this season. I mean, I think Dallas is probably right there with that next mix. But a point guard upgrade, if such a thing can be done this season, would certainly go a long way in helping them.
It sounds like you think that they'd be okay with more of a spot-up shooter that kind of lets Dirk, Parsons, Monta, you can run the offense through them, and you just kind of get, like, in a weird way, a 3-and-D point guard would be the best fit for them.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, if there are Patrick Beverley types available, I think that would go, you know, that would certainly do them a lot of good. Just because, as you said, I mean, Monte initiates a lot of offense, and they still run a lot through Dirk, but they're not isolating him like they used to. They want to put the ball in Chandler Parsons' hands in certain matchups. And so, yeah, when you're leveraging those kinds of players to their fullest abilities off the dribble and on the pass, yeah, the need for a guy who's going to be breaking down opposing defenses at the point guard spot isn't really necessary. And so the Mavs, you know, when they've gotten in trouble offensively, a lot of times, frankly, it's because Jameer Nelson or Devin Harris or whoever is maybe doing a little bit too much and, you know, forcing some mid-range fadeaways. You know, they're really getting stuck in that intermediate zone where they go around a screen and they know that they don't want to drive into a helping big around the basket, and so they settle for these floaters or little fading jumpers. And when the Mavs offense gets bogged down to that kind of action, that's where things really grind to a halt for them.
Now, Dirk passed Olajuwon for 9th all-time in scoring. Now, as someone, you got your start in this with a Mavs blog, and you've been around for pretty much his whole career. What are the intricacies of his game that you've enjoyed over the years?
Oh, let me count the ways. He's an unbelievable player, and seeing kind of the full course of his growth. You know, I think all basketball fans and anyone who's been around the game for any length of time has that kind of guy who they've anchored themselves to in terms of, you know, the way they experience the game and their fandom of basketball in general. And Dirk is certainly that guy for me where, you know, growing up in the Dallas area, kind of living and dying with Mavs games when I was younger, seeing him go from this, you know, strictly jump shooting, really awkward rookie to the guy he is now, it's just been an unbelievable transformation. And all the steps along the way where, I mean, this is a player who, you know, at 7 feet tall has endured every criticism that could possibly be lobbed at a big man in terms of what he should be doing or isn't capable of or whatever, calling him soft and that kind of thing. And he's rewritten the book about what a post player should be. He's one of the most efficient post scorers in NBA history. He's one of the most prolific scorers in NBA history. And to see him do it from, you know, isolating at the elbow where, you know, he kind of proved single-handedly that it's impossible to double-team him there without him picking you apart, to transitioning to, you know, really being a great low block guy, especially on that left side for the Mavs over the years. And then on top of that, you know, the pick and roll brilliance, whether it was with Steve Nash or Jason Terry or Jason Kidd or whoever. All the phases of his career have been really, really a joy to watch. And you know, it was cool to be in the, you know, in the arena last night for him to when he passed that record.
What when you first started watching him as a rookie, what did you think he was going to become, and how surprised are you that this is where it ended up?
I mean, I don't know that I was really in any position to say, just because I certainly wasn't watching the NBA like I do now. And so to whatever I thought he was going to be, it wasn't worth much. But, you know, certainly seeing those first few years, there is a case of, I think Mavs fans realized relatively quickly, especially in that, you know, I think it was his second and third seasons, just how special, you know, there was something there. There was an ingredient there that was pretty unique. I don't think anyone, you know, following the team at that point, at least at the level that I was, imagined this kind of outcome where he was going to be, you know, a franchise savior, really, and, you know, the anchor of a team that won 50 games for, you know, I think it was 11 years, the stretch there, and then eventually winning an NBA title. I think he surpassed all reasonable expectations for his career, especially given, you know, just how awkward and how uncomfortable he looked there in the early going.
All right, as before we transition to the rest of the NBA, do you have anything that's coming up on the website that you'd like to plug?
Oh, no, nothing in particular. Just, you know, keep checking us out at SI.com. You should have lots of fun stuff coming up in, you know, this week and all weeks.
All right, so the Heat, I'm going to be honest. I thought Bosch was going to have a great year. I was worried about Wade, and I really didn't think the supporting cast was all that great. They've been really pretty solid to start the season. What do you think, outside of Wade and Bosch playing at an elite level, what do you think has been the key to their success?
It's a lot of little things. Getting good minutes out of Sean Williams, for one. I mean, this is a guy who's bounced around for a lot of different teams and has occupied a lot of different roles, but to get him into a nice little stretch role is really good for them in terms of spacing. You know, point guard-wise, I think Shabazz Napier's surprised me a little bit in terms of how ready he is to play and to contribute. And, you know, Eric Spoelstra playing a lot of two-guard lineups there with him and Cole or him and Chalmers or whoever, and those have worked out pretty well. You know, and they've done a lot of this without, you know, with Josh McRoberts playing relatively few minutes, all told. You know, considering that, you know, he and Bosch were supposed to be, you know, what their front court look was going to be like going forward for this season. – to do a lot of this without a guy in McRoberts who is a decent shooter, but he hasn't really been shooting much this season, is a great passer for his position and at least a serviceable defender on a team level. To get as far as they have already, while kind of integrating him slowly, I think is a testament to how well they've played and how well they're moving the ball. I mean, I want to pump the brakes a little bit on them, just because, you know, the thing about that team and the reason why so many people were so hesitant to go hard on them in the preseason, I think has so much to do with health. And, you know, there are a lot of teams around the league for whom you can say this, where if they lose one guy, they're going to be in a bad way. But that team in particular, I mean, if Wade or Bosch goes down for any length of time, you know, I think the Heat are going to be in a really, really tough spot in terms of creating offense. And it's not like, you know, as good a player as Lou Aldang is and as all these supporting guys who have stepped into their roles have been for them, I don't necessarily see a lot of options there in terms of scrapping to deal with any significant injury.
Yeah, even with someone like McRoberts, that's kind of caught me off guard. If you would have told me they would have gotten so little out of him to this point in the season, I thought that would have been a really big issue, because he's their fourth best player, and there wasn't much behind him. But as like having someone like Sean Williams go back to what he was able to do when he was playing with D'Antoni and the Knicks has been a real key for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as if this whole thing is just, you know, LeBron has been sidelined for a couple weeks, and it's almost the same team that they trotted out last season in a lot of ways. You know, they don't have Mike Miller, they don't have Ray Allen. But otherwise, it's been kind of those familiar faces for them that have been really good, with just some little minimum salary guys or rookie in Napier's case who have come in and played good minutes. It's a really bizarre situation, but I think a lot of credit goes to Eric Spoelstra in terms of kind of just tweaking what they do just enough, but they really haven't redefined themselves in any significant way. They run a lot of similar actions. They just do so with these really awesome workarounds in terms of their ball movement and their collective passing, and then, you know, really utilizing Bosch in a slightly different way, where he's a little bit more aggressive and he gets the ball in some different spots. But really, the end results are the same. You know, they're able to get to the line sufficiently. They're able to work inside enough, and certainly create 3-point shots for guys like Williams and like that guard core.
And I like that Bosch has continued to shoot threes, even though he has taken on a bigger role in the offense. Has Spoelstra adjusted how they've used Bosch defensively at all because of the bigger role on offense?
I honestly haven't been able to pay too close attention to what they're doing defensively in terms of if that's a difference. From what I've seen, they still have him playing pretty high on pick and roll, but those could have been matchup issues. We'll kind of see over the course of the season how it ends up leveling out. But yeah, I'm curious to see how that plays out over the course of the year. And that's another thing with Bosch, especially when you're talking about, you know, as I mentioned before, a team that doesn't have a lot of options in terms of dealing with injury. You don't want to wear down Bosch over the course of the year either. You know, he has a great track record in terms of being available for them and in the past for Toronto, but he's certainly a guy who, given the offensive load that he carries for the Heat, I don't know that you can afford to have him playing so high against so many teams over the course of a full season.
In terms of the context that the expectations for these two teams was to win an NBA championship with the Clippers or the Cavaliers, which one are you a little bit more concerned about at this point in the season?
That's a good question. I would say I'm a little more concerned with the Clippers. I mean, I don't think either one of them, I mean, they're certainly both in that contending category. I wouldn't necessarily say that they're, you know, at the front of it. There are teams ahead of them, you know, kind of both for the same reason. You know, the Clippers defensively this season have not been sharp, and they have a lot of problems on offense too, just in terms of some of their guys' skill sets are starting to become a little bit more cluttered, they're bumping up against each other a little bit in terms of spacing, and of course that, you know, the wing positions are starting to be more of a problem as teams pick up on that. But Cleveland is kind of, I think, offensively, they're going to round into form and be more or less what was expected of them. You know, a potentially great offensive team with a really, really problematic defense. And so, with them, you know, this is going to be a multi-year process, assuming that they can hold on to Kevin Love and assuming that they can progress offensively to the point where they can fulfill those expectations. It's going to be, you know, for Cleveland, a matter of over time, can they get those pieces to build a championship caliber defense? And maybe they will, maybe they won't. With the Clippers, I think there are some big questions already in terms of, you know, what does this season mean for, you know, where's Chris Paul in his career? You know, he's certainly pacing himself in the regular season, as he usually does, but to, you know, how effective will that be? Blake Griffin does not look physically right now necessarily. I don't know whether that's lingering injuries. I don't know whether that's, you know, just a bug that's going around, an illness or something like that, but he certainly doesn't look like the Blake we saw last year, and that's at least a little bit concerning. You know, you don't want to write him off just yet, but yeah, it's certainly not a good sign. And then what that means for DeAndre Jordan's potential free agency too, where, you know, he and Griffin get along together on the court in some ways, especially with those high-low lobs, but they're not a perfect fit, and especially when, you know, Jordan defensively has not been at the top of his game so far this season, and if he's not, you know, a great interior defender, I don't know how much the Clippers want to play with the idea of paying both of those guys big money to coexist long-term.
No, for those two, for the spacing to work with those two, it's Blake's extremely well-rounded skill set that kind of lets it work, because he can pull off some really nice interior passing that can pick apart in small spaces. They've moved Jamal Crawford to the starting lineup and playing him with Redick. I mean, that kind of tells you where they're at those wing positions, that they have some serious issues there, because that's not what you're looking for at your 2-3 when you're trying to build an elite defense.
No, certainly not. And it's going to be a problem for them, just because they don't really have a lot to play with in terms of trade assets. They don't have a lot of room to work with, given that they're a team that has to take into account the hard cap financially. So, yeah, I mean, Redick can be an okay team defender. Probably is a little bit better than he's given credit for widely. But, you know, Crawford is not good on that end. And Paul has not been good so far this season. You know, he hasn't been his best defensive self. He's certainly capable of being one of the better defensive guards in the league. But, yeah, I mean, even outside of those guys, I mean, Matt Barnes at some point is going to have to hit a shot. Reggie Bullock at some point is going to have to get – they're going to have to at least trot him out there and see what he can do. And they've done that – you know, Doc has done that a little bit so far this season. But they're just at a point where, I mean, desperation, I think, outweighs any accountability in terms of, you know, I'm sure Jamal has his expectations of minutes. I'm sure Matt Barnes has his expectations of minutes, but they've got to throw everything, you know, at the wall and see what sticks here, just because I don't think any of the wing solutions they provided thus far are really title caliber.
It's funny that a guy they almost traded for last year probably would have been the perfect fit and exactly what they needed at the 3 in Iman Shumpert with how he's played this season.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's one of those things, too, where, you know, there are probably dozens of those cases where it's guys they've looked at. I'm sure they're looking at more candidates now, but Shumpert's another guy where there certainly have been times where he doesn't look as good as he does now. He's on a nice run, you know, offensively and defensively both. But, I mean, the other thing with Shumpert, too, is he's a really good defensive option in terms of a guy that you want to throw at a ball handler or a guy who gets a lot of touches. But he can get lost off the ball, too. He can get, you know, he'll stray from his man a little bit more than you would like. So he's certainly a better option defensively than what they have. But I don't know that he would necessarily solve all their problems.
He's not perfect by any means. From the Cavaliers' perspective, are you starting to see the chemistry with their top three guys come together a little bit? The offense kind of straightened itself out in that Pelicans game. They finally got clicking a little bit.
Yeah, they looked a lot better. I mean, at least, you know, efficiency-wise, in terms of their output, they were a lot better. They're still doing, you know, it's still some one-on-one stuff, but, I mean, that's the thing with when you have players that are that good, you can get away with that. When you have LeBron James, when you have Kyrie Irving playing that well individually, you can get away with that. And then when Kevin Love's knocking down threes, I will say they looked, you know, they were running at least a little bit more pick-and-roll than they have. And they were a little bit more fluid in terms of getting into those actions, whereas before it was, you know, LeBron or Kyrie ISO, and they would kind of call for the pick as a means of getting into their isolation, as a means of separating from their defender a little bit. These were more, you know, LeBron executing from the wing in kind of a pre-planned arrangement where, you know, the feed to Varejao is there. And you could see it in terms of the quality of looks that the Cavs were getting at the rim, where, you know, New Orleans, I mean, between Anthony Davis and Omer Asik, like, that's a team that should be locking up the inside. And the Cavs were at least able to pry that loose a little bit just in terms of getting their bigs looks on the move, going towards the basket, away from a couple defenders. And so that's certainly a positive sign for them. And just the little just the little chemistries in terms of the way, you know, especially the way Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love are working the pick and roll, I think is gives you reason for optimism there. I mean, they're gonna figure things out. They're a really talented team with a really bright coach. I think it's really just kind of a matter of time for them offensively.
He got a lot of attention for all the offensive rebounds he got against the Bulls, but how do you think Tristan Thompson has fit in with this group so far?
He's not bad. He's not bad. I mean, you see, you know, as with Love and as with Varejao, you know, the bigger problems are defensively. You know, where, you know, Varejao is a fine defender, but with this team, you're constantly called back to what he can't do for them. I think it's the same with Tristan Thompson, where Thompson has these moments where he looks like he could be a shot blocker, but then there are also moments where he'll go, you know, chasing after a potential floater and give up a wide open layup, or he'll just stay ground bound as a guy kind of goes by him. And so there, he certainly isn't what they need there. But I love the way that he tries to dunk everything. You know, even no matter what, you know, who's next to him, no matter who's around him, he's certainly audacious in that regard. And so as a viewer, that's kind of fun, and it's a cool thing to watch, especially when, you know, you have these bigs around the league who probably could and should do that, but don't. And so Thompson, you know, he goes hard on the offensive glass, which is nice for them, as you mentioned, and then that he can convert those opportunities or at least get to the free throw line a little bit, or at least, you know, challenge opponents a little bit. I mean, he's a nice role player for them, but another guy where as soon as you're going to, you know, they're going to have to pay him money soon. And when that point comes along, what it means for the Cavs in terms of their long-term flexibility should be interesting to watch.
Two point guards, speaking of having to pay money, there's two guys that are going to be free agents this upcoming offseason. Reggie Jackson's going to be a restricted free agent. Brandon Knight's going to be, I'm pretty sure he's unrestricted. If you were building a team, which one of those guys would you prefer to invest money into? They've both looked solid to start this season.
I think I will answer this question with a resounding yikes.
You don't like either.
I mean, I like them both in particular roles and in particular situations. And when you look around the league, I mean, I think part of the problem with this point guard market is that these guys can look at one another. You know, Reggie Jackson can look at Kemba Walker and say, I want that money or I want that kind of contract or whatever. And maybe he just, like, I'm not a huge Kemba Walker fan either, but I think, you know, and then Kemba's looking at Eric Bledsoe, and Eric Bledsoe's looking at so-and-so, and so there's just this chain of comparison in terms of what these guys are doing with their agents and how they're negotiating. But if I'm building a team long-term, I don't know that I would want to be paying either Brandon Knight or Reggie Jackson a lot of money. I like, on their rookie deals, in their particular roles as they're constructed now, especially, you know, Jackson with a potentially, with a healthy Thunder team, I like them both. And for a team like Milwaukee, Knight turned out to be a great gamble for them in terms of, you know, as a potential return in the Brandon Jennings deal. You know, I think he's done a fine job, and he's shown a lot of growth there in terms of his ability to read things. There's still some problems with those two guys that I don't necessarily think are going to be sorted out in a way that would be conducive to high-level basketball. I'm not trying to say this is an indictment of them. I just don't know that I would want to be the one betting on their development at this point.
Okay, so let's start with Jackson. Where do you think he's struggling that concerns you long-term?
The over-dribbling bothers me. And this is, you know, it's a problem that a lot of young point guards have, and Jackson's situation is particularly unique in that obviously the Thunder have all these injuries, and he's looked at as the guy who is supposed to be creating offense for them. But still, when a young point guard, you know, and this was true with Durant and Westbrook as well, where I think he looks off a lot of options that are there, and it's just these little decisions, you know, where he's a little, you know, a cutter will go through the lane, and he just doesn't, I don't know whether it's a recognition issue or whether he just doesn't see it as being a good option or a viable alternative, but he'll hold on to the ball a little more than I would like. The perimeter shooting is touch and go, and that's fine. You know, you can deal with that, depending on who else is on your team, but it's at least something you need to consider. Defensively, I certainly don't love anything that he does. I think he's competent. I think he's okay. But I think you fall into a range where, especially with point guards of this caliber, there are so many good to great point guards in the NBA right now that if you're the guy holding the bag when an okay to good point guard hits free agency, you know, you could be committing a lot of money just for the sake of, oh, I don't want to lose a potential starter. Oh, I don't want to lose this guy that's been a part of our franchise where, you know, all these other teams are at least getting better players at a position that's supposedly loaded for comparable contracts.
Same question with Knight. Where are your concerns with his development long term?
I think Knight's issues are he's still a little unpredictable, I think, even to himself, because he still does that thing where he drives into the lane without much idea of what he's going to do.
He makes some weird passes sometimes.
Absolutely. And you know, there are point guards who can get away with that because they're so athletic, because they're so, you know, they can adjust on the fly. They have such incredible body control, and they have such incredible vision. They can get themselves out of those holes. But I don't think Knight is necessarily that kind of guy. And so there are plays where, I mean, he makes some pretty nice reads on occasion, some pretty nice finishes. But then for every one of those, there are two plays that are just kind of head scratchers in terms of he'll get caught in the air or get caught, you know, in a double team that he didn't intend. And so there are all these little problems in terms of the way he breaks down and reads opposing defenses. And you know, at this point, he's had some experience. So it's not as if he hasn't had his reps, you know, as a first option playmaker for a team, or at least as a high usage, or you know, a relatively, you know, middle to high minute player for a couple of teams. So with him, I do wonder at what point you're going to really get a lot out of him in terms of his ability to make plays. And if that's not what you're looking for, if you're looking for, you know, more of a scorer type or a guy who can spot up from the perimeter, I think maybe he's a little more viable. But if you want him to be a traditional point guard creator, I think you may run into some problems in terms of what his ceiling is going to be in that regard.
So it sounds like from both perspectives, you kind of like these guys as your prototypical first guard off the bench, come in, get theirs, give the offense a boost, and kind of prop up the second unit where you could run some offense through them.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're both kind of dynamic players in their own right. It's just a matter of do you really want Reggie Jackson or Brandon Knight, you know, holding the ball, in possession of the ball, with the responsibility to create on possessions that matter? And I don't know that long-term I would really want to bank on those kinds of guys. They're certainly good players. They're certainly good players to have as a part of your organization. I haven't heard a bad word about either of them personally. You know, Reggie Jackson, there's certainly been some stuff lately in terms of, you know, understandably kind of, you know, wanting to make his presence felt, you know, with Durant and Westbrook out. And there's certainly that issue, the reported issue, with Kendrick Perkins and Serge Ibaka kind of freezing him out to teach him a lesson. But, I mean, those are the kinds of things I understand, especially with a guy who's been asked to come off the bench for a really good team, that, you know, when given the opportunity to start, he would want to get his a little bit. To me, it's more just a question of, how much do you really, really want to rely on those kinds of players in a league where there are so many point guards who are better than them?
To wrap it up, so far, I think we're about 2 weeks into the season, somewhere right around there. What's been one thing what's one takeaway you've had to this point?
I mean, there are certainly a lot of them. I would say off the top, Toronto is really, really good. And I don't necessarily know that I expected them to be this good. You know, the continuity helps and, you know, bring back basically a full roster with a couple of little additions, Lou Williams and James Johnson and guys like that helps. But I think it's really striking that in a conference where there's going to be some unsettled teams, you know, Washington has their injuries, Cleveland has their issues, Chicago has looked, you know, good and bad depending on the night, and depending on their injury issues too, to be fair. But just the void in the Eastern Conference, I think, is maybe a bigger opportunity for the Raptors than we expected coming into the season.
I actually picked them to finish second. I got a whole bunch of stuff in my picks that's going to end up being wrong. That's something I actually did okay, though. But there's a lot more wrong than right there, but since you brought that up, I will say that.
You got to take them when you can get them, trust me. I'm sure plenty of people will let you know everything you did wrong. So you got to speak up for yourself when you're going right.
See, I like making fun of myself when I get stuff wrong. It's fun. I don't mind. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it. Always appreciate you jumping on. Make sure you check out his stuff over at CNNSI.com. Is that still I know it directs it to it, but is that the official one that you type in, that you're supposed to type in?
It's all going to the same place. Just SI.com works just as well.
Okay. I've gotten into such a habit of typing that for such a long time, and it still does go there, so I just keep doing it. But thank you, and that wraps up this edition of the Podium Game Podcast.